I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold. There are 1 billion, not million, billion women in the world today who have no access to financial resources or tools. And low-income women are especially vulnerable to economic instability in the developing world.
Today we're speaking with Mary Ellen Iskandarian,
President and CEO of Women's World Banking, who works with 51 institutions in 28 countries to reach these low-income women with financial services. We ask her about the work she does to achieve economic parity and how the inclusion of women in the economic system can lead to growth and to prosperity for their families and communities. Here's Mary Ellen.
Hello, I'm Mary Ellen Iskandarian. I'm President and CEO of Women's World Banking. I've been there since 2006, which is sort of remarkable. But the organization's mission since it was founded 41 years ago has been to make sure that low-income women in developing countries have the full range of financial products and services that they need to ensure that they have both prosperity and security. And that was something that was very important to me before joining, but now really has become my absolute passion. And I see pretty much every issue in the world through the lens of, oh, if only women had access and control to finances, then pretty much every problem would be, if not solved, would be made much better.
Did it start really with women, or I think it started in 1975, right, as a UN conference in Mexico, and then, but was the focus then already women, or what happened?
No, very, very much so. As you rightly point out, a group of women met at the first UN conference on human rights for women. And they, you know, were listening to all these speakers, and there was so much energy around the issue of human rights that they realized that women would not be able to really take full advantage of all of those rights if they didn't also have economic rights. And so then over the course of the next 4 years, they built a movement and created in 1979, Women's World Banking. It was first established in the Netherlands, actually. We had a lot of support from the Dutch government and some absolutely wonderful people that we're still very close to in the Netherlands.
Can you give us a nice example about how women are the fabric of economic empowerment in a community or within? Is there a specific example you can give, or maybe the first time you went to see and really saw, wow, this has impact? What is the impact?
The first trip that I took for Women's World Banking, I met a client of our partner in Kenya, Kenya Women's Finance Trust. And it was a woman named Joyce Wafuko. She lived in a village about an hour's drive or so outside of Mombasa. And I was meeting a very, you know, prosperous Joyce, who had been a longtime client of Kenya Women's Finance Trust. But she told me sort of the story of how her business had started, and she'd found KWFT. Her husband had gone to the city to find work because there just wasn't enough in their community to keep their family going. And she noticed that all of the people in town, you know, was constantly working on their homes, but there really wasn't anything like a hardware store for miles. And so she decided she was going to set one up. And she showed me this great picture that is not like any hardware store you've ever seen. It was a little kiosk on the side of the road, and she sold tomatoes and eggs and some loose nails and some old 2x4s. And that was her shop. And she exhausted, you know, all of the savings and loans that she could get from her family members, but none of the formal financial institutions would give her any money to grow this business. And she was introduced to Kenya Women's, which was and still is one of the largest microfinance institutions in Kenya. They made her a $70 loan and gave her some training on budgeting and how to run a business, basically. And so flash forward to the 7 years later, after I met her, she had a $3,000 revolving line of credit for a very proper hardware store that you would have recognized anywhere. And I think what's so important, and really to the answer to your question, was, you know, sort of as she'd grown the business, she had put all of, you know, her three kids through secondary school, and they were all on their way to college. She'd put her younger sister through graduate school. And, you know, the whole time we were talking in the back room of her store, there's this kind of like this buzzing sound, buzzsaw sound out the back door. And it turned out that she had hired, you know, 25 employees up until that time. And her 26th employee was her husband, who'd now come home from the city. And he was establishing a lumber yard, a lumber business that had a big contract from the state education authority, and they were going to be building and refurbishing classrooms. So growing the business that much further. And, you know, I was just recently from the World Bank. So I started asking all sorts of questions like, you know, turnover and what interest rate are you paying on your loans? And, you know, she had all the answers to those things, but the way she talked about her business and the way she measured her success was all around the education of her kids and, you know, how well her family was doing and the health of her family.
It's amazing that $70 can make so much difference to a whole family in Kenya. And I wonder if you could give us a sense of exactly how that works in micro lending. Like, what is the process that someone have to go through? And why isn't it a practice that's more applied even in developing countries like ours for low-income women or people in need?
Well, the traditional microfinance product is a very small loan for a productive purpose that is usually unsecured. So it's really based on ideally the cash flow that the business is generating. The really old school microfinance model worked on a group of people would come together and borrow as a group. There would be individual loans, but the group would be responsible for repayment. But the industry's really kind of moved a bit from there, and they're now making individual loans. I think part of the reason this model hasn't really translated as much into developed countries is that unsecured element. That in the United States, we are just, if you don't have collateral, if you don't have something to pledge against a loan, it's very hard for you to borrow. That's why so many small businesses really fund themselves off of credit cards for so long, because that's sort of the closest thing to an unsecured microloan that we have in the developed world.
I mean, I've heard from microfinancing projects in India, and the interest rates there ranged, like the one project I personally got to know, I think I had 21% interest rate. And I was, you know, when I talked to the guy, I was like, oh, that's a bit much, you know. I thought it was like horrendous. And he's like, oh, no, we are actually so cheap, you know, in comparison to all the others. And I said, what do you mean? He's like, well, some of them take over 100% of interest rate. And that's just like for a Western ear, it's like, no, you must be kidding. But women, in particular women, you know, if you don't have any other choices, this is what you accept. Like, what about your products or fair offers, so to say?
No, I'm glad you raised that, because, you know, I think about, I'd say about 10 years or so ago, when it became so clear that mobile phones and cell phone technology was really the way low-income people in developing countries were going to be served with financial services, you just saw an explosion of players come onto the field. And frankly, microfinance now is certainly one of them, and it's an important way that many, you know, I think there are 200 million people around the world, low-income people, who are still borrowing through microfinance institutions. But in part, because of those very high interest rates, you've just seen so many other models come into play. And I think that's been one of the biggest shifts in our organization as well as in the industry. So today, as I say, we're still working with microfinance institutions, but we're working with cell phone companies, retailers, many mainstream banks that, because the cost of delivering services through that cell phone is just so much less expensive, they see this as a really viable market. in the countries they're working in. So the whole cost infrastructure of microfinance, as you're referring to, has shifted quite dramatically in that period of time.
To what extent does cryptocurrency play when you're talking about cell phone delivery? Do cryptocurrencies have a role here?
It's a great question. Crypto hasn't yet started to play a role. And I say yet because I can certainly see in the area of remittances, there's a lot of buzz about how, remittances are still just horrendously expensive around the world. And yet they represent, significant percentage of GDP for many developing countries to have money sent home. So anything that's going to be able to lower that cost is very exciting. But while crypto isn't so much of a feature, many fintechs and even blockchain is really starting to be a real game changer in terms of the way remote people and previously excluded people are able to tap into the formal financial system.
Yeah, I can imagine that blockchain, it's notorious for taking out the middleman, so to speak, and therefore many of the fees. Do you see that as a trend happening now? And is it helping to kind of police these predatory microlenders, the 100%ers?
I mean, right now, the main contribution of blockchain, interestingly, is around identification. Because having an actual identity that is usable in a financial setting, let alone a digital identity, is an enormous barrier. For I think there are a billion people in the world with no identity at all, no legal identity. The vast majority of them, as always, unfortunately, are women. And then that digital aspect is quite a going to be an important development in the future if we're going to take advantage of all of this exciting technology.
It's just an amazing number, 1 billion people, right? I'm interested in that microfinance versus donation. I mean, why is microfinance so much more effective, in would you say, than, or could we not just give that money today?
Well, the universal basic income and the give directlies, and there's, it's a very it's a very exciting trend. I'm not necessarily opposed to it at all. What I want to make sure that we're doing once that money is in people's hands, once they are able to either, establish businesses, is make sure that they have the other financial services. That's, in my mind, that's the big difference between, say, microfinance, which is purely credit-based, and full financial inclusion, which is about insurance, which is about savings. And what I do worry about is, a donation, comes onto your cell phone, but there's not necessarily a bank account that you could save some of that money in, or a premium that you could pay, an insurance premium so that you have a safety net. And as we're coming out of, hopefully, this pandemic, we're seeing so much interest on the part of the women that we're working with in that safety net. They've been saving throughout this whole crisis, and we've had a lot of interest in some of the life and health insurance products that we're working on.
So I guess donation doesn't really give education with it. So that's what I kind of hear from you. It's kind of more than microfinance and all this other kind of ecosystem of finance kind of gives you partly an educational empowerment with it. Is that correct?
Also infrastructure. I mean, it sounds like what it gives you is all the stuff you need once you have the money too, right?
Right. And it's been such an interesting, I think that COVID's given us such an interesting example. Pretty much every country in the world has had some kind of social protection program that they've either adapted for COVID relief or they've created for COVID relief. And we're seeing in so many countries that you know, people are either opening accounts. In India alone, 25 million accounts were bank accounts were opened in order to receive that payment into a bank account. But then what they actually, you know, do with that money once it's been donated, you've got to have other products. And as I say, we've been very excited and impressed by the desire for savings, because they recognize that this, you know, this may happen again, and they don't know when they're going to be able to go back to work. And remittances from wherever their relatives were have dried up because those people are out of work. So having that ability to build a safety net in addition to the donation that one time is so important.
Yeah. Do you see a future where the people that are growing their businesses from the micro lending world becoming eventually maybe competitors for financial products? I mean, in other words, are you also educating people to manage their own financial systems and develop banks and develop like local ways to empower even more people?
Absolutely. I mean, the work that we're doing is all about creating local capacity and creating, you know, well-informed consumers of financial services who know what they need, know when they're being charged too much for something. And, you know, we find this all the time. I remember so well a conversation I had with a woman who worked in a garment factory in India. And she was incredibly articulate. She was getting a regular salary, so she had that monthly. And she said, if I could just have a product that I could pay a little bit every month so that when my child gets sick, I would have that money to pay for his. And, you know, when we started talking about insurance, she'd never heard the word before, but she knew exactly what she wanted. And I do think so much of, at the end of the day, what we do is listen. Because these women in particular, they know what they need. They know what they want. They may not call it something that is the technical term, but they know what the need is.
What kind of barriers do you see? Like, you know, as there's a billion women, according to your website, who don't have access to financial capital of any form. What barriers exist to overcome, and how can we overcome them in your mind?
So one really big one that I feel like I've been talking a lot about cell phone technology and the wonders of mobile financial services, but there are, you know, 300 million fewer cell phones in women's hands than in men's. And I do very much worry that if that does become the mode of transmission for financial services and women don't have access. Now, access on a regular flip phone is down to 7-8%, but it's for a smartphone with internet access, which really is what everyone is using, you know, with apps or what, you know, whatever is being offered. That's 20, in some countries, 30% gap between men and women. So for us, that's sort of first among equals, if you will, in terms of barriers. We've already talked a little bit about identity. That's also, you know, just absolutely critical. But then the technology can work on that, because, you know, if your phone becomes your bank, your SIM card can become your, you know, your identity.
Wow, we would basically need a phone company who donates.
Yeah, what about Apple? Don't they donate? Or like it seems like Apple could solve that problem in a matter of minutes, right?
No, it's really interesting. I never thought about that. You know, I've always heard like mobile phones is kind of the new revolution in Africa. Yeah, like the mobile peso, I think it's even in Kenya, it kind of exploded in even comparison to crypto in Western countries. And yet that actually women don't have access kind of never really, you know, that they actually do not have, as you know, like the physical hardware in their hand. I never got to know that.
Yeah, women are much more likely to share a phone with another family member, but, you know, a woman is not going to bank on a phone that she shares with somebody else. And that we see that in so many cases that the confidentiality and privacy is so important to the woman in terms of financial control.
Do you find barriers with culturally within women's attitudes themselves? Like, oh no, I don't want to use the technology, or no, my husband handles the money, that's not for women. Is that still a part of the conversation, or is it just a huge demand that's not being met?
Well, it is a huge demand that's not being met. The cultural norms around technology and cell phones has surprisingly been, you know, leapfrogged in many, many places. South Asia still has quite a bit of traditional gender norms that really are making cell phone ownership and usage on parity quite difficult. There's a tradition of, you know, girls having to be, you know, very pure during courtship, and there's a perception if they're on a cell phone conversation, and God forbid they're smiling and laughing on that conversation, that, you know, the traditional courtship norms might be breached. Mothers are supposed to be, and, you know, married women are supposed to be completely, you know, devoted to care of the family and the home. And so she shouldn't be, you know, wasting time or unproductive time on the cell phone. So we're finding in South Asia that those gender norms are still pretty strong around the technology.
I was wondering if women are generally speaking better with money.
You know, there's been a lot of research on this. There's this, you know, women spend a lot more money on the household. There's some really fascinating research on, you know, if you give a direct government payment into a bank account that a woman has control over, within a matter of a couple of months, you see everybody's, you know, nutrition and dietary habits are so much better. You see everybody in the family being, you know, much, much healthier. More kids are staying in school for longer. So the things that women tend to prioritize with their money are those kind of long-term intergenerational benefits that, you know, healthier, better educated, better housed people, you know, grow up to be healthier, better educated, better off individuals. There's also quite a bit of research that women tend to be more risk averse. So, you know, men may be more willing to take a gamble with their money than women are. So there's research on both sides, but certainly that idea that the household does tend to be better off when a woman has control, that seems to be pretty solidly proven.
I have a question for you that I like kind of ponder. In a lot of ways, I think Western households have suffered, and I don't mean this at all in a patriarchal way, but because both parents are working, okay? And I wonder if there's a way, like one of the maladies I was talking about outside of climate change and labor exploitation is the fact of when money becomes accessible to the whole family, then there's a shift in the focus, right? And I'm not saying this in a gender way, but I'm wondering if there's a way in which these kind of women's sensibility to take care of the household could be spread to the men, so that, you know, the kind of paid labor is only half and the unpaid labor is the other half, and both parents kind of partake in both sides of that question.
You know, I'm not sure if this is necessarily an answer to what you've said, but it really struck me. We've been doing a lot of work in Indonesia that has this really huge, really effective, it's called a conditional cash transfer. So if it's always been tied to kids' education. It wasn't designed explicitly to go to women, but that's who the payments have gone to. And it was really the first time that I'd actually, you know, talked to women who were happy to have the payment, and that's the program that Indonesia has used in COVID. They've made the payments more frequent, and they've just kind of used those rails to get the COVID relief. And so the women have been very glad that, you know, they were the ones who had the accounts. But, you know, they were very candid in saying, we don't really like being the ones that have to carry the whole burden of making sure that this you know, great gift from the government that's designed to help our kids, that it's not going to happen if we don't do it. That they really wish there were a greater sense of burden sharing, if you will, mm-hmm. with their husbands. And I'd never really heard that before. You know, from where I sit, I'm always, you know, banging the drum that, oh, you know, you give the money to the women and the kids get educated. But these women were quite eloquent in saying, we wish it were not the only ones in the household who were seeing this benefit. So, yeah, you know, maybe more men need to be making that same conclusion.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really the future, is that none of us work 40 hours. We all work 20 hours and we all take care of the family the rest of the time. And, you know, that would bring equality to a whole new level. And, you know, I think some of these financial tools and universal basic income, or however, you know, like some combination of distribution of wealth that allows for that flexibility within a family structure. And then, of course, you have to deal with all the, like you say, the cultural norms, you know, that prevent that from happening.
And I countries. Guess while we're dreaming, we got to make sure that the women who are working the 20 hours get paid as much as the men. The wage gap is still just
crazy.
And it only seems to really be closing, at least in the United States, for white women. It's mm-hmm. stunning for Black, Latinx, what the wage gap still is in so many places in this country.
Is there a counterpart to the kind of work you're doing in the United States for women?
You know, I'm not aware of any, you know, one place like us that does everything. There's some great there's some great microfinance going on in the U.S., The Financial Health Network, I think, has some of the best research on and you know, advocacy around how many people are still really financially excluded. They don't have a gender focus, but you know, I always look at their stuff because it's just astonishing how many people in this country still, you know, don't have access. Bias, you know, there was a lot during the summer and following the George Floyd murder, there was a lot of stuff written about banking while Black, and there's just some tremendous bias. Mm-hmm. We're going to have an economist from the University of Pennsylvania come talk to our team, because a lot of my staff are really interested in these issues in the U.S., even though we're not working here, just how during the subprime crisis, how targeted Black women were for subprime mortgages, even when their credit scores were absolutely qualifying for a regular loan. So there's still just a tremendous amount of bias, both racial and gender bias, in this country that, you know, maybe that's the next place we go.
Is there anything we haven't asked you which you feel is important, or alternatively, what's the vision for the future?
I know we weren't gonna be prepared for the questions, but I did really like the questions you asked around gender lens investing, because I think, you know, we sort of talked about the difference between donation and, you know, building financial capability. I think there's also a real difference between, you know, the work that we do as a donor-funded organization, providing technical assistance and support to banks and insurance companies in the developing world, and then the impact we can have as shareholders of those organizations. Women's World Banking has $125 million under management in two gender lens investment funds, where we invest directly as a minority shareholder in inclusive finance institutions, primarily microfinance, but we're doing some fintech and investment in the second fund in the developing world. And being able to, you know, be an activist shareholder, and we're focused very much not only on serving women clients, but doing so through gender diverse organizations that have women in their leadership and in their governance and in their staff. And our ability to kind of push that agenda and bring other shareholders along with us to push that agenda is so much greater as an investor than it ever would have been as a donor. And so I think that, to me, that's a lot of the future, is making sure capital gets pushed in this direction.
Yeah, that's super cool. How would an audience member invest in one of these funds or become a part of that movement as a shareholder?
Well, please contact womenswworldbanking.org. We are very much in our capital raising mode, so I'm not allowed to say too much more for this second fund, but would very much love to talk to anybody who agrees that putting this kind of capital to work to make finance work for women, we'd love to have that conversation.
Anything else, Mary Ellen, you would like to, like, really is coming from your heart as a message, as a maybe final message from you to our listeners?
I think just one thing we're all so conscious of is that, you know, whether it be, you know, peace treaties like we were talking about before, or coming out of natural disasters, women have to be a part of leading their countries out of chaos and into resilience. And that will be the case with COVID as well. So making sure that women have the financial tools to do that, to be resilient and to recover. I heard someone say it's not so much build back better, but build forward better. And so I would support that wholeheartedly.
Well, I think first, I just want to express my own awe at 1 billion women. Mm. That's an amazing statistic. It's because you're talking about 1 in 8 people on the planet who have no financial access. And that's significant. Mm. You know, every adult should have a right to make their own money, save their own money, spend their own money. And I guess many cultures don't really support that. But also our financial institutions are quite exclusive.
Yeah. For me, this episode, I mean, it's super interesting. All the statistics Mary Ellen comes up with, you know, I especially like the mobile phone story, which I really didn't realize. I never thought about that there are more men having mobile phones in developing countries. And hence, again, women are sort of excluded from the system. Or while they're sharing their mobile phones, obviously, you wouldn't share your banking information. So this confidentiality, the identity problem, all of that super interesting in this particular subject for women. Mm-hmm. And I completely agree with you. You know, we should have a finance system which is fair and open to absolutely everyone.
But this is also a stepping stone, as we started to get to toward the end of the episode, where, you know, what we really need is a system where people have control of that tool as well, right? Not central banks, but, you know, more kind of peer-to-peer networks, kinds of different kinds of people exchanging with different kinds of local currencies, or even with national currencies, but at local levels. And I feel like we're entering an age of technology where we can skip straight to that, right?
Right.
I mean, soon it's going to happen. And maybe those micro-lending deals will trickle down into that kind of network where you could have mutual credit systems. And, you know, I think there's huge possibilities coming up, coming very, very soon.
Right. And we've actually mentioned this a little bit in the episode with blockchain, the possibilities through blockchain, which is not the same as Bitcoin. Just, you know, some, I think there is a bit of confusion out there. But what the possibilities with that technology and what it actually offers us as humanity is tremendous, is huge. The system we create on top of it is our decision, whether we make it inclusive or exclusive again. Right. And I hope, my hopes really is that through decentralized finance, for example, what's currently being in the creation process, so to say, is more and more open and inclusive to everyone. And that should be our aim. And especially of course, including women.
Right, absolutely. But I think Mary Ellen is clearly on board with that. You know, like they really want to empower people. And bravo, more power to them.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore. Thanks for listening.